Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
When we couldn't ship product to China, the crops, livestock products, they backed up here on the domestic market.
From the recent Ag Outlook Forum, Acting Deputy Undersecretary at USDA, Jason Halfmeister.
They hung over the domestic market. We saw lower sales, so less quantity sold. We saw lower prices since U.S. products were not the most attractive product and for global traders, and this resulted in less income, right? Price times revenue. This less farm income then ricocheted through the ag economy. There was less off-farm jobs, there was less farm services provided, and rural America suffered. So this really helped concentrate our minds about, oh my gosh, this could happen again. We need to be better diversified.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This chart here shows our top six markets for agricultural exports. They account for about two-thirds of our total exports.
Jason Halfmeister is Acting Deputy Undersecretary at USDA.
The dramatic line there is China in red, where you could see the dramatic fall with the tariffs in 2018 and 19, and then the rebound, which basically got us back to our traditional growth path. From WTO accession, and then the last couple of years. But so China in some ways exemplifies this topic, because when we lost the China market 2018 and 19, we were all scrambling to try and find alternatives. This is our top 20 agricultural export markets. I don't know if you can make them out. You see Mexico, Canada, and China. They're our top three. They're head and shoulders above the rest. And of course, China has now fallen to third, but Mexico and Canada are up there. So those three, they account for half of our exports, once again showing sort of a concentration, a little bit of exposure. And then you can see the top six, that's two-thirds of our exports, the top 10 and the top 20. So really two lessons for me out of this is one, like the need to be prepared if we lose one of these big markets, because we can't easily replace them. And then second is that there is a lot of, this is a long tail, right, in this curve here. There is money to be made in those smaller markets. And so that comes together here when we talk about diversification. We don't want to sell less to China, Canada, and Mexico. This isn't your retirement portfolio where you don't want to be overweighted. Like, we want to sell more wherever we can. We think there is more business to be done in China, Mexico, and Canada. But what can we do in these other markets to build them up, to give us more customer base there? All right, so that was markets we look at. This is a way to look at it on products. So there's soybeans showing off, you know, on the far left there. They get their own metric, you know, it's too big, they blow everybody else. And then corn, beef and pork, tree nuts. So you can see here's ranked the products we're selling. So in addition to diversifying who we sell to, it's worth thinking about, do we want to diversify what we are selling? And so a couple ways to look at that. One is, do we just want to sell soybeans, or do we also want to sell soybean meal and oil and biodiesel or corn? Do we also want to sell DDGs? Do we want to sell ethanol? Do we want to sell corn on the hoof, you know, sell more livestock products? So there's certainly diversification within products, but there's also a possibility to diversify across products. And so I don't want to forget, so we got corn, soybeans, and apples, pears, and cherries up here. So we got fresh fruit, too. That's part one of our candidates here. And so similar questions about how overweighted are we in a particular market, but also is there other ways to present what we sell? All right, so these are products. Here's another way of looking at concentration. This shows which products have 50% or more of our exports go to one country. So there's sorghum. Like, oh my gosh, 90% of our sorghum goes to China. Right? 9 out of 10 rows planted to sorghum is destined for China. Very, very exposed. And you can see as you go down the chart there, sort of who is relatively more diversified than others, who is more exposed. Same chart, just sort of flipped around the other way. This shows how many markets you sell to get to 75% of your total exports, right? So there's sorghum, one market, and that's more than 75% of our exports. And then you go all the way across here, poultry, where we're totally diversified, right? Lots and lots of small poultry markets for us. Take our chickenling quarters and our other poultry products. So, you know, these are measures of concentration. They get to this point about the exposure we have to bad events and how diversification should be part of our strategy. But not at the expense of selling less to the big countries. How can we sell more in other places?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Farmers are generally profitable, but then you look at 2024, 2025, and we're seeing a very different story. And quite likely, Seth, you can tell me if I'm completely wrong, but I would guess if you're redoing this today, your soy numbers might look a little bit lower.
Scott Gerlt is chief economist with the American Soybean Association.
If that's the case, that 2025 bar is going to be even worse. Now, we do know that the economic assistance package is going to be rolled out, but that's about $30 per acre for soy. So, you know, if you look at total costs, it's about $100 per acre loss at the national level.
And it's a demographics issue.
Low birth rates around the world. I mean, our largest market, China, has a declining population at this point. You know, the country now with the largest population, India, is nearing that same point. Really, the growth in the future appears to be in Africa. If you're going to think long term, there's obviously a lot of development challenges in Africa, but U.S. soy is working actively in Africa to try to build those markets long run. On seed oils and pesticide, those are things that are very critical for our farmers. There's been a lot of research done on safety of vegetable seed oils, making sure to point that out. Human food consumption is half of our domestic use of soybean oil. And also on pesticides, we've lost dicamba for over-the-top use for this growing season. And that's really affecting our farmers. So we want to be able to continue to use these tools, provide cheap food, to continue to do no-till and other conservation practices. Because if we do lose those, that's going to be a competitive disadvantage. I mean, I showed some of our competitive advantages in those spaces compared to Brazil, right? If we lose that, then all of a sudden that's another incentive to further expand in South America. It's not necessarily that there won't be crops grown somewhere. Do we want to be out of the export market? Do we want to have to be thinking maybe long run we might have to bring some imports in? Or do we want to be doing this ourselves?
So what's the future of biofuels?
For those of you who've had the pleasure of not having to deal with this for the past year or two, California is the main renewable diesel market. So when we talk about all this growth, it's primarily descended to California. And they have generally not viewed ag feedstocks very favorably. They tend to give us high carbon intensity scores. And so they're doing some rulemaking recently. And on top of that, they're putting in what they're calling sustainability guardrails that would require traceability through the system. So you'd have to be able to point to where the land that soybean came from. The other thing is they're capping the feedstocks of soybean oil, canola oil, and sunflower seed oil at 20% by company for biofuels going into the state. Right now, they're probably using upwards of 30%. So it would matter. Those are all tried to address the same concern on indirect effects on this carbon intensity score. So really, it's a triple redundancy. The rulemaking has passed CARB. Right now, it has been blocked by their Office of Legal on some technical grounds. We're still waiting on the exact state of play. But this has been something, frankly, that the environmental justice community really got in CARB's ear at the last minute. And CARB made some very quick 180s at the last minute on some of these changes. And it matters. I mean, that's one of the primary markets. So we're still working on that. I wish I had a clear path on how all this will play out. But it'll be pushing less soybean oil to California. Hopefully we can absorb it in some of their states. But all that remains to be seen.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Our partners and the Northwest Horticultural Council use a lot of different programs to develop different markets.
Talking trade with the president of the Northwest Horticultural Growers, Mark Powers.
And we'd like to increase the number of markets we sell to around the world, but increasingly we're forced to focus on protecting the home court. And for us, that's Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., we've reoriented in a large part from global to regional focus. For pears, it began about a decade ago, and for apples in 2020. The decision was made largely due to factors in export markets that, honestly, the private sector doesn't control. Tariffs, pesticide, MRL regulations, competition from other countries and advantages competitors have over our growers. That could be subsidies, lower costs of production, logistics. What we're seeing is not reassuring when it comes to decreasing our reliance on a small number of markets. Take Mexico and Canada. So they take about 60% of our apple exports. That's the three-year average. If you go out to a six-year average, it was 55%. And if you go back further years, it was lower. So the trend is not positive. For pears, Mexico and Canada take 91% of our exports. Other challenges, we are responding to our global in nature and also the nature of our product. We promote to consumers and we promote to the trade. We try to both push and pull demand while recognizing we don't really sell directly to consumers. We sell to importers, wholesalers, wholesale markets, and retailers. Again, using China as an example, 55% of our sales are direct to retailers and 45% to wholesale. It used to be flipped the other way around. In fact, going back 20 years, it was almost all wet market wholesale sales. E-commerce is another change that I would point to. Okay, the programs we use, I think, that are specific to specialty crops are a couple of important ones. TASC would be one. Technical assistance for specialty crops. We've been associated with about 22 projects since 2002. That's when that program was conceived. And it allows us to really focus on specific bilateral issues. It kept Korea open for cherries, a critical market. It allowed us to work on grade standards in UN ECE and Codex as well. The other one is ACE, Assisting Specialty Crop Exports. This was rolled out last year. It still, I think, has some additional funds that are available to roll out, but it's focused on non-tariff barriers to trade. I think very positively so. I'm going to take the opportunity to give a shout out to people at USDA, my career friends, USDA in particular, USTR, obviously. For us, it's not the private sector that opens and maintains export markets. It's the U.S. government. Market development programs are positive and beneficial collaborative efforts to increase exports, but they can't remove barriers to trade or provide U.S. growers fair access to markets around the world. Only the U.S. government can do that. I think you all know that, but I felt it important to say it.
And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I don't think I need to convince anyone here why we should care about food prices.
Megan Schweitzer is a USDA Economic Research Service ag economist.
Food price changes have impacts across the economy. They affect producers, they affect retailers and consumers. And for scope, agriculture and related industries contributed about 5.6% of U.S. GDP in 2023. And then food also makes up a significant share of consumer spending. In 2023, spending on food accounted for about 12.9% of total U.S. household spending. And food ranked as the third highest major spending category behind only housing and transportation. In addition, price changes for essential spending categories like food and housing, they may impact some households more than others. Lower income households spend a higher share of their after-tax income on food. So for example, in 2023, households in the lowest income quintile spent about $5,300 on food, which was about 32.6% of their total after-tax income. And in contrast, households in the highest income quintile spent about $17,000 on food, or about 8% of their total after-tax income. And then lower income households also adjust their share of spending on food more during economic downturns, as we can see during a few of these downturns over the past few decades. And so I'm here to talk primarily about the ERS food price outlook. And what these data are, they provide annual forecasts of price changes up to 18 months in the future. And so in the food price outlook, we are forecasting the change in the consumer price index and producer price index for a set of food and agricultural product categories. We forecast annual food price changes for 35 categories total, 22 retail food categories from the consumer price index, which are the products that consumers purchase, and then 13 farm and wholesale food categories from the producer price index, which is tracking what producers are paid for their products. And I'll focus on the consumer price index forecasts and trends today. And in contrast to what Eliana just presented, I'll be focusing specifically on consumer spending, so not the full slate of government or industry spending, but specifically what consumers, what households are spending, and the prices that they are facing. And then these food price outlook data, they're published monthly with a written summary findings and a set of data files. So we update these forecasts and publish them monthly. And so starting off, just taking a quick look at prices across the economy in 2024 to give us an idea of how the food price changes from last year compared to other spending categories. In 2024, prices for all food, so both food at home and food away from home combined, rose by 2.3%. compared to 3% total for average prices across all categories, or what's often called the all items index. Food prices rose more slowly than housing and medical care, but faster than the other major spending categories tracked in the CPI. And then just a quick look at where 2024 fell in historical context. So food prices actually rose by less than their 20-year historical average rate of growth in 2024. So that 2.3% was below the average rate of 2.9%. And then in contrast, the all items CPI was still running slightly higher than its long-term average of 2.6%.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm also a farmer, and, you know, price is important, costs are important, but what's really important to me is what does that margin look like?
Speaking recently at Commodity Classic, Krista Swanson is lead economist with the National Corn Growers Association.
As Scott alluded to, and Seth, you know, this is using those numbers from last week. So as you could imagine, if we see some of these tariffs and potential retaliation start to impact price to the downside, that bar on 2025 could drop even more. And what's already concerning to me when I look at it is that, you know, it's already the lowest level since 2005, and that's notably before the ethanol expansion era. And so, you know, we're looking at already using last week's projections, a corn margin per bushel that is at that level. And, you know, another thing that's important to me, we've heard a lot about the price signals for more corn acres. And if you look at corn versus soybeans or cotton or spring planted wheat, price has been signaling corn acres. But again, what are farmers thinking about? They want to know what is that profitability expectation. And this is including some soybean numbers that Scott just had up, the same look. But, you know, you compare corn across soybeans, wheat, sorghum, that profitability picture is not great across the board. And so corn isn't necessarily more profitable, even though those price signals are there. I will note here that this is just averages. This is based on those average cost of production. One thing I learned as I talked to some of our grower members from across the country is that this varies a lot. You might be in an area where the relative basis in your region would make one of these crops a lot more profitable than the other, even though this is what the average says. You might have soil types that make one of these crops more likely to yield more, no matter what kind of year. And so, you know, individual farmers might have a profitability picture that looks a lot different from this, and that's where we might see some of those acres that are swing acres go one way or another. Seth last week, brought out that February projection for corn acres at 94 million compared to 90.6 last year. One of the things I wondered as I thought about this was, you know, how do final acres normally compare to that February projection? And I found that in 10 out of the last 15 years, final acres were lower than the February projection. And interestingly, a number of those were also those weather event years where weather has the final say. But also in almost two-thirds of the years, final acres were within 1.5% up or down of that February projection. So if we think about what that could mean for this year and the potential for acres, a two-thirds profitability or two-thirds probability that final acres might be between 95.4 or 92.6 million. And, you know, what I really want to know, though, is what does that mean for stocks use and price? And, you know, that forecast last week was for 15.6 billion bushels of corn. It would be a record crop and 12.9% stocks to use. If we think about what that means in a low acre or high acre scenario. But I also want to throw on top of that, you know, if we have one of these, farther out of the normal range, so to speak, but we also have a demand swing from the projection and or a yield swing. If all the cards fall in one direction or another along with acres, I think that we could see a stocks to use ratio, pushing 15-16%. And on the other end, if the things fall the other way, we could be looking at something below 10%. And, you know, that makes a really big difference in price for the producer and their bottom line at the end.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We focus on three main strategic goals as we do our work.
Jim Sutter is the CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council.
Differentiating U.S. soy, elevating a preference for U.S. soy, and making sure that we have market access or attaining market access for U.S. soy. And we do those things in a wide range of different ways that we do them. But those are the real key things that we're trying to do. So when we have ideas for new projects, have ideas for things we could work on, we pretty simply put them through that kind of a test and say, is this going to do one of these three things for us? And that kind of helps us know whether we should proceed with that program or not. So USEC is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. As I said, ASA and USB created USEC, but there's a much longer history of doing international marketing. And prior to that time, it was done by the ASA International Marketing Group. So that was kind of a subset under the American Soybean Association. We've been active in global trade for a long time. Japan since 1956, the Americas region, El Salvador, Mexico, Venezuela since the 60s and 70s, Belgium since the 70s. You see that picture there. Singapore, we opened our Southeast Asia office in 1979, and then China since 1982. So now let me get into a little more. That's kind of the history of the organization, and that's everything you wanted to know about USEC, maybe more, but I have a captive audience, so I love to talk about that. But now let's talk about China, because I think it's on everybody's mind, and certainly in all presentations today, it's probably something that people are talking about. So I would call this a story about the success of diversification. And you may say, China, what do you mean success of diversification? So let's take a step back in time. I said that USEC, or the predecessor organization, started doing work in China in 1982. At that point in time, China was a small exporter. They were exporting some soybean meal to other countries. They didn't become an importer until 1995. So 13 years of work by the soy industry, probably working together with FAS, to try and turn that into a market. So soy farmers who put their first check off dollars, I think they were very worried. I've talked to some of the farmers that were around that. I was not involved at the time. But I've talked to some farmers, and they were worried about how much of the soy industry's exports were going to the EU and to Japan. So they were trying to diversify by opening up a market in China. Well, things change, don't they? In about 5 years ago, almost 50% of our U.S. soy exports were going to China. So we've had, maybe we overshot the runway a little bit on our diversification efforts. China is a big, big market. You heard Greg Dowd comment this morning that there is really no replacement for China in terms of a market for certainly U.S. soy, but for many U.S. agricultural products, just because of the sheer size and scale of that market. But we're happy that last year, the last marketing year that finished, just under 40% of our U.S. soy exports went to China. So from over 50 down to less than 40. So it's going in the right direction from a diversification perspective for us. But clearly, it's not a market that we want to give up. There's a lot of numbers I'll throw at you, but China imports 60% of the global trade in soybeans. So remember, they first imported in 1995, and they grew to 60% of the world's trade by 2025 or 2024 last year. So we can't ignore that market. We can't totally get away from it, but we're trying to right size our share of the China market.
It's agriculture today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The annual outlook for this year's organic farm and food sector, as revealed at this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum, included acreage trends for organic ag. Agriculture Department Research Economist Sharon Raskap-Skorbianski says Argus data indicates,
in recent years, we have seen drops in total organic land, led mainly by decreases in pasture and rangeland, but we also did see a decrease in field crop and non-field crop acreage in 2023.
Yet mid-February data from Argus reveals
a reversal in pasture and rangeland and in field crop acreage. Total organic land is up to 7.9 million acres, up from 7.7 million acres in 2023.
On the trade side, more organic imports and more of those high value are behind increases in 2024, with organic exports stable. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.